Today is Friday, February 25th. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky again called for a meeting with Russian President Vladimir Putin to de-escalate the situation as their forces engaged in battle around the capital city of Kyiv. VOA's Heather Murdoch shares what she's seeing on the ground.
Throughout the afternoon, we've heard bomb blasts in the distance, pretty far away, but distinct. We've also heard a little bit of gunfire.
Plus, Russia clamps down on protests in Moscow in opposition to the fighting.
They don't want nothing that can disturb the narrative of the Kremlin.
And later in the program, lessons learned from a century of opposition to authoritarian rule. From the Voice of America, this is Flashpoint Ukraine. Good evening. I'm Steve Miller. VOA continues to monitor developments in Ukraine and the international response to Russia's invasion. And for the latest updates, please visit voanews.com/flashpoint. Ukrainian and Russian forces fought on the outskirts of Kyiv Friday, the second day of Russia's invasion of Ukraine, as diplomatic efforts to quell the violence continued and Western nations moved to shore up allied defenses. And not long ago, I spoke with VOA's Heather Murdoch, who was in the Ukrainian capital.
Throughout the afternoon, we've heard bomb blasts in the distance, pretty far away, but distinct. We've also heard a little bit of gunfire. We've heard sirens, certainly, indicating that there might be another attack. But if there is going to be a full-scale assault on the center of Kyiv, it has not yet begun. We've heard reports, and I say reports, but they could be reports that have been born from rumors, that officials are still negotiating, frantically trying to find a solution for this city that does not include more violence. But we've also heard equally credible reports saying there are going to be more attacks tonight or early tomorrow morning. What is going to happen? It's really not clear. Everyone here is completely on edge. It's no different than this morning in terms of the city being empty, people not being on the streets, businesses being closed, people being scared. There's some hotels that are open here and they're operating, you know, in a very skeletal way. The staff of the hotel that a lot of the journalists are staying at, that we're staying at, they're all living in the hotel as well. And the food that is available for everyone is limited and the resources are limited. But we went to another hotel and the reception had just left. So the people who were staying there didn't really know, like, there's no more like infrastructure or organization left in the city at the moment, because anyone who could has gotten out.
Heather, as you've traveled throughout the country and are there in Kyiv, what are you hearing from people about the government's response?
Before yesterday, people were saying to me that they were trust that their government was negotiating and also preparing for war and would protect them if it had to and try to negotiate its way either out of the conflict or with Europe and the West to defend Ukraine from Russia if the conflict did begin, which it has now. Not everyone, of course, was so confident in the government, but there was quite a bit more than I think we're seeing today, because at the moment, we've heard all these stories and seen all of these people moving, including ourselves, as Russian forces came into this country to take over. So it's kind of just amazing, like, what happened to this military that was prepared to fight for every city and town and to defend this country? Where did they go? Why did this happen so fast? So there's a lot of questions as to what's going on. When I say there's a lot of questions and lack of confidence for the government compared to what there was the other day, this, of course, cannot possibly apply to the whole country because it is diverse with a lot of differing opinions about the government and about their handling of it. I'm just speaking about the people we were talking to in their reactions.
Heather, thank you very much. And please, please be safe.
Thank you so much.
The U.S. State Department is also warning that Russia is creating a disinformation campaign by publicizing false reports about the widespread surrender of Ukrainian troops and that Russia plans to threaten killing the family members of Ukrainian soldiers if they don't surrender. NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg also opened a special leader summit on Friday where it was later announced that NATO was activating defense plans to prepare for a wide range of contingencies. The NATO summit comes as European Union leaders announced what they called massive sanctions against Russia for invading Ukraine. As the leaders continue meeting on Friday in Brussels, that's where Luxembourg's foreign minister says that the 27-nation European Union is very close to agreement for asset freezes of Russian President Vladimir Putin and Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov. Lisa Bryant has more.
This is the European Union's second set of sanctions against Moscow in less than a week, along with those imposed by the United States and other Western powers. EU leaders say they will hit Russia in five areas: the financial, energy, and transport sectors, as well as through export controls and visa policy. Ursula von der Leyen, president of the European Commission, the EU's executive arm, says they will have a maximum impact on Russia's economy and its political elite.
This package includes financial sanctions that cut Russia's access to the most important capital markets. We're now targeting 70% of the Russian banking market, but also key state-owned companies, including the field of defense.
Officials say the sanctions will freeze transactions from many Russian banks, ban sales of aircraft and spare aircraft parts, and limit Russian access to key technologies, among other effects. The latest measures come as Europe faces its biggest security threat since World War II. It is already seeing the fallout as Ukrainians fleeing the conflict begin crossing the border into Romania, Hungary, and Poland.
L'Union européenne a décidé donc ensemble d'infliger des coups très sévères à Moscou sur...
President Emmanuel Macron of France, which holds the rotating EU presidency, said France would add its own sanctions to the package and warned war had again returned to Europe. Macron spoke with Russian President Vladimir Putin by phone Thursday. Speaking to reporters early Friday, he described the Russian leader as duplicitous in his conversations with him. Across Europe, people are taking to the streets to protest the Russian invasion of Ukraine. Analysts like Marie Dumoulin, senior fellow for the European Council on Foreign Relations, believe the Ukraine crisis is helping to bring the sometimes fractious 27-member EU together.
Putin is helping the Europeans to be united. I mean, if he had kept his sort of hybrid strategy, feeding uncertainty, and then there may have been divisions. But with this all-out war, I don't think there will be much division inside the EU.
Skeptics, though, suggest EU sanctions may ultimately have a limited effect on Putin and his intentions when it comes to Ukraine. Lisa Bryant for VOA News, Paris.
You're listening to VOA's Flashpoint Ukraine. I'm Steve Miller. Hundreds of Ukrainians protested in Australia's largest city of Sydney against the Russian invasion of their homeland. Phil Mercer reports the Australian government has also criticized China for undermining Western sanctions against Russia.
Stop Putin now! Stop Putin now!
Australians of Ukrainian descent joined those with Russian heritage to demonstrate against the Russian invasion of Ukraine in downtown Sydney Friday. It was an act of solidarity, many thousands of kilometres away from the conflict in Ukraine. Protesters held signs urging Russian President Vladimir Putin to stop the killing. The Australian government has joined the international condemnation of the Russian attack. Prime Minister Scott Morrison also condemned China for undermining Western sanctions against Russia. In early February, China's President Xi Jinping and Putin agreed to boost trade ties. Australia insists the agreement was aimed at undermining the United States' network of global alliances and any sanctions that it would impose on Russia. Morrison urged China to act responsibly.
You don't go and throw a lifeline to Russia in the middle of a period when they're invading another country. That is simply unacceptable from the reports that we have seen. And I would urge all nations to say this is not a time to be easing trade restrictions with Russia. We should all be doing the exact opposite.
The Chinese Foreign Affairs Ministry spokesperson suggested Thursday the attack shouldn't be called an invasion because Russia was only targeting Ukrainian military bases. Morrison had previously described Russian invaders as thugs and bullies. Australian Defence Minister Peter Dutton has said that China's President Xi might be one of the few global leaders who could persuade his Russian counterpart to halt the invasion. The Australian government will send medical supplies, financial support, and military equipment, but not weapons to Ukraine, to help its fight against Russia. The Russian embassy in the Australian capital, Canberra, has said sanctions imposed by Australia were xenophobic. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
On Thursday, Russian police detained more than 1,600 people who were protesting against the military operation in Ukraine. Earlier, I caught up with Ricardo Marquina in Moscow to learn more about the detentions and how the fighting is being portrayed in Russian media.
Well, I can assure you that this is not 2014 when Russia annexed Crimea. In that moment, you can saw in the street really happen. Everyone was agree that was good for Russia. We saw honest demonstrations of happiness in the Russian population all around the country. This was global, and this was true. Maybe we can comment if it's not legal, but the feeling of the Russian people was happiness. That is not the case anymore. So I can see around me people that surround me, friends, family, co-workers, and also people in the street. You can feel it in the street. There are, people are anxious, nervous, not happy. I can assure that the majority of the country don't want to Russia to bomb the neighbors. There are two very close countries. A lot of them, Russian and Ukrainian, feel each other as brothers nation.
Ricardo, what else can you tell us about the reports of these 1,600 or so people that were detained following the demonstrations on Thursday? And really, how people are reacting there, not only in Moscow, but other places that you have seen and traveled throughout Russia?
Well, the usual protocol when this demonstration happened and there are massive arrests, yesterday all around Russia was almost 2,000 people get arrested. So usually they spend 3 hours. If some of them, they have, previous arrestation situation, maybe they can spend the night. But in the next day, all of them, they are free. So it's because we will see the same demonstration maybe tomorrow, Saturday, or Sunday. And it's not clear, but will be more, that's for sure. So these people is not arrested for more than one night. That is usually the case. But it's true that the Russian authorities don't want to these videos in Twitter, in YouTube, in any social media to spread, to showing that the Russian army is selling, civilian areas. They don't want to see, also, people don't see Russian soldiers dying, bodies of Russian, these videos that they're already in social media. They don't want nothing that can disturb the narrative of the Kremlin.
To that point, the authorities have said that they are planning to perhaps block media reports of the protests or of opposition, calling it false information. So is anyone reporting on the conflict?
We see that there are so really brave Russian media that stand for this profession to try to tell the truth and to show all the aspect of one news. So for example, today, and Novaya Gazeta, the famous newspaper, his general editor is the Russian Nobel Prize, Muratov. So they go today to the street with a bilingual journal in Ukrainian and Russian language, saying that Russia is bombing Ukraine. Also, the independent TV Dost Rain, they still go on live every day trying to show both sides of the his story. So even if Russia, the Russian services is trying to block all the info, finally some brave journalists make it. So they make the difference.
Ricardo Marquina, reporting from Moscow, Russia. Paul Post is a political science professor at the University of Chicago, and he explains to me how the history between Ukraine and Russia could have a broader impact on the world.
So the first thing that I'm paying attention to is the extent to which Russia not only invades further into Ukraine and potentially tries to take all of Ukraine or part of Ukraine. That's one key thing to keep an eye on. Of course, a lot of people are paying attention to that. But the next step for that, and this is something I don't think is being fully appreciated by folks who are watching this, though definitely it is being appreciated by the Biden administration. If Ukraine is easy enough to conquer, maybe I can push further. And then suddenly you worry about, would he try something with the Baltic states? That's where you would start to have concern. Now, if that happened, that would be a game changer, because now you're having direct invasion of a NATO country.
Which would then trigger Article 5, the collective defense agreement among NATO countries, that states an attack on one is an attack on all. And NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg has clearly said that they will work together to defend every inch of NATO territory, something that was also reiterated in President Biden's address.
So, yes, if Putin invades, if he views the invasion of Ukraine as, say, easy, relatively so, and he says, you know what, I'm going to go further. Well, where would he go? The Baltic states would be the next logical place. But, yes, that would be a game changer, because it could trigger Article 5. The other thing that I think is worth paying attention to and thinking about how these things are related is paying attention to the actions of China, because what's happening in Ukraine, does it either provide motivation or even cover for China to pursue more of its revisionist path or revisionist interests towards territory surrounding it, right? I mean, over the past couple of years, we've seen China engage in conflict with India in the Himalayas because they have a territorial dispute there. We've seen heightened tensions between China and Japan in the South China Sea because they have maritime and territorial disputes there. Of course, there's China with Taiwan. And then we've also seen China with the policies that it's imposed on Hong Kong. And you could actually, to me, what I find interesting is thinking about the fact that China pursued those policies. Did that inspire Putin to say, hey, now's the time to actually pursue my own revisionist policies vis-a-vis Ukraine? Or is it going to go the other way, which is that now that Putin is taking this line towards these countries, and if the West doesn't take a hard enough line, if it seems like it's relatively easy for Putin to accomplish these aims, does that lead China's government to say, you know what, I wonder what kind of response we would have if we were to push harder on our territorial disputes, because China has a number of them. That's the interconnected piece that could lead to this becoming a much broader global type of crisis, not just one that's limited to Eastern Europe.
Paul Post is a political science professor at the University of Chicago. Ruth Van Giat is a professor of history and Italian studies at New York University. She recently spoke with me about the research that went into her latest book, Strongmen, Mussolini to the Present. She began our conversation by tying together historical threads as to what makes a strongman.
As the leadership style, they have a similar personality and similar ways of doing things. And one is that they are pretty much amoral. They are transactional. They are opportunistic. And so they have success because both getting to power and then sustaining themselves in power, because they will do things that others won't do. And they also take advantage of opportunities, or sometimes help to create those opportunities. There's sometimes mystery around those, like the Reichstag fire, or the apartment bombings when Putin was running for president in 1999, 2000. So they are willing to take risks, and in the end, those risks can sometimes see them in later in their tenure in office.
One of the things I wanted to ask you about is in your book, you discussed the so-called strongman playbook. And in some instances, Russian President Vladimir Putin has been described as a strong man. So looking at your research, where do you see the Russian leader in terms of following the things that you laid out in your book?
So very important component of why people support these men is that they channel, you know, the idea of national greatness, that they will save the nation and they will bring it to greatness. But, so that's the kind of utopia. And they're modernizers. So Putin is known as a doer. And he has, you know, his kind of personality profile, personality cults. He's always, he's very fit. And he distinguished himself from Yeltsin early on in that regard. But they also channel nostalgia. And so it's always about making the nation great again. And so with Putin, there's, you know, this kind of nod to Imperial Russia, but of course the restoration of the power and influence of the Soviet Union. And so what the way I interpret what's going on now with Ukraine is, you know, he's been trying to revive this version of the Soviet sphere of influence with the client states, and of course Belarus has Lukashenko has acted very faithfully in this regard. And so this is a big part of the appeal. The other part of this is that strongmen have something called personalist rule. And these are personalist dictatorships. There's a lot in the 20th century, but they continue on, where the personal preoccupations and concerns and sometimes obsessions of the leader become, they influence national policy. Domestic and foreign policy. And we know that, you know, Putin was very wounded by the collapse of the Soviet Union and all of his speeches when he does his annual address to the nation, the Valdai Discussion Club, all the big profile things. He's always talked about, you know, defending Russia as victimized by the West, which is an old theme, but also defending Russia and making it safe from incursions of Western, illiberal Western democracy and moral degeneration. So you want to create almost like a safe space, a buffer zone around your country. And that's also what I see the, you know, aggression against Ukraine. That's part of the kind of sphere of influence. But Putin himself is very affected by this need to have safety and the need to banish any possibility of Russia imploding the way the Soviet Union did.
One last question. Your book actually spoke about acts of solidarity and dignity that undid the authoritarian rule of so-called strongmen. What can you share about your research?
Yeah, so I have a resistance chapter, and I also end with talking about how there's that love, actually, love and solidarity and values of restoring human dignity, because what do autocrats do? They dehumanize us, they exploit us, they degrade us. Those have been very effective, not just rhetoric, but, you know, tactics to helping to get rid of strongmen at the right time. So I have examples of, you know, in Chile, when the only time practically a dictator was voted out, the opposition banded together. You have to have unity of the opposition, and that in itself is an action that shows solidarity, compromise. But in Russia, too, there's a new generation, Zhukov and others, who openly talk about love and solidarity. So I think we're going to see more of this. You had in Turkey, the mayor of Istanbul won on he called it a radical love platform. So there are these, it's almost like a counter-populism, but focusing on solidarity and fellowship and compassion. And it might sound idealistic, but it has actually worked in certain situations as a political strategy, and it's there motivating resistors to autocracy today.
That was New York University professor and author of the book, Strongmen, Mussolini to the Present, Ruth Ben-Ghiat. That's going to do it for us today. On behalf of the entire Flashpoint Ukraine team, thank you for listening. I'm Steve Miller. Be well, be safe, and good night.